Take heart, dear friends. We are passing through the darkening of the light. We're going to make it, and we're going to make it together. Don't get ground down by cynicism. Don't let depression darken the glass through which you look. This is a garden we live in, a garden seeded with unconditional love. And the tears of the oppressed, and the tears of the frustrated, and the tears of the good will spring those seeds. The flag has been waved. It says occupy. Occupy Wall Street. Occupy the banks. Occupy the nursing homes. Occupy Congress. Occupy the big law offices. Occupy the lobbyists. Occupy yourself. Because that's where it all comes together. I pledge to you, from this moment on, whatever it means, I'm going to occupy myself. I love you. See you tomorrow.
It's very important sometimes to just quietly sit back and not even ask yourself questions, but just try to figure out some very simple things, even without words. For example, we're talking about death tonight. And we take for granted, and I suppose rightly so, because being the kind of creatures we are, we have to take about 99% of everything for granted, but we'd spend most of our time out of action, just being amazed and wigged out by how perfect and really uncomplicated the whole thing is. But one question that comes to mind is, why are we born to die? Why death? I mean, we take for granted, as I say, right? That, you know, you're born, you die. You grow older, you mature, you die.
It's only a way of looking at things, old
Peter. Yes, I know, but it's a way that seems to happen to everybody. We find it faintly amusing when certain wealthy movie stars try to preserve their youth. They try to look 30 when they're 60 or 70 or 80, and one day they go up in front of the mirror and lift the shade and... It's gone. You mean, I'm 85 years old and I'm still thinking like a 30-year-old. I don't know what to do. You know, they say, grow gracefully into old age. Yeah, that's a bummer also, I'm sure. Everybody's got an idea on how to die, but nobody sits down and asks, why death? I mean, why? What is there specifically natural about somebody being, you know, being born, growing, maturing, and dying? Why does there have to be this thing called the end? Now, most people are scared of dying. I don't think I could rightfully say that I'm not one of them, David. No, you know, think about it. It's not even dying violently, which is something we try to escape by putting it in all of our movies and television shows. That's okay for the guy in the black hat on the black horse, right? But not me. It's not going to happen to me. I'm going to die.
Kill yourself dead, George, and don't forget the audience. And it's been great talking with you.
You too, Peter. So long, buddy.
Goodbye, bye-bye, Georgie boy.
Well, how about that, buddy? Old George.
Wonderful to hear his voice again.
So you really took a major step when you decided,
yes,
Mr. DeMort, to have only dead clients. It was tough for a while, wasn't it?
Well, you know, for a while I handled Procter & Bergman. They were the only live dead clients that I had. Since their career was so very slow, I guess 10% of nothing was really nothing in that case. But you know, with the dead people, 10% of nothing is something, because I do have to share it with their estates.
Why are we here today?
Well, because we're still alive.
Yes, that would be the answer. It's the only Phil and the lonely Dave.
That's right. We're the two surviving members of the Firesound Theater, which is really an odd thing to say. But it's the way things presently are. We lost Peter Bergman 3 months ago now.
3 years.
Right? And we lost our dear Phil Austin about a month ago to similar ravages of various forms of cancer, and eventually for Phil, heart failure.
And we survived. It was especially shocking because for both deaths, they were completely unexpected.
Correct.
And great surprises, and took us quite a bit of time to, in Peter's case, you know, it was the Radio Free Oz Peter Bergman, you know, I mean, we came out of his program, and so it was as if the leader, our great leader, had gone, you know.
I am the mayor, and I'm the big cheese. Dang me, re-elect me, or hang me. That's the will of Bill.
Yeah. then when Austin passed away, it was like, well, wait a minute. He was really the heart of the thing, you know? And so we had to look at it. I looked at the way we worked together completely differently after Phil died.
That's true. What was strange and a little unsettling in Bergman's case was that he knew that he had this condition, a leukemia, a form of leukemia, but he didn't share it with us. And so it was shocking when he finally revealed the extent of his disease, and it was really a little too late in the game for him to do anything to prolong his life. And so he left us really a lot faster than we anticipated, or than he anticipated, for that matter.
I am the multitacular Mr. Motion, master of amazination, vast as my reputation.
Terrible. Brooke.
Yes, that was my next guess.
Brooke Esmeraldian. Wow.
It's and, also your next
and
guess.
Brooke, and Brooke. And Brooke. She's a piece of work. Brooke is a gorgeous, zoftic force of nature who was Peter's best man, you know? I mean, she and Peter, he and she were a great couple. They traveled to Turkey together, where she practically, you know, caused a revolution because she was so pretty.
This is Side 5. Follow in your book and repeat after me as we learn three new words in Turkish. Towel. Bath. Border. May I see your passport, please?
This is a poem for Peter. It's called 12 Suppositions. You must have been coming up from the eye of the Bosphorus. You must have been working with stones where the walls come down to the river. You must have been traveling fast over the roads hidden by ruins. You must have been talking with seasons as they rose in the east and made patterns. You must have been breaking your nails on the branches of lime trees, on the books of tables. You must have been eating sherbet and dates. You must have been shouting at the devil as he stood on the water. You must have been half dead with fever, half alive with a woman. You must have been remembered, forgotten, and sent back where you came from. You must have been alone in the camp of the enemy, a flag in your pocket, a coin in your pocket, a hand in your pocket. You must have been close to the fire, warm and dry as sand. You must have been coming up from the eye of the Bosphorus with a return ticket and an empty pack of cigarettes and a keychain when she found you.
And Peter was doing research for a play, a movie he wanted to write. And Brooke, later, when they split up, married Simon, John Simon, a mutual friend of all of ours, and moved to Woodstock. And John Simon is a pianist, musician of some fame. And when I, after I did A Safe Place, I remember I traveled with a girl I had fallen in love with up to Woodstock to visit them, to visit Brooke. And then many, 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 many years later, I had an affair with Brooke. And you just have to pass it along, pass it along, pass it along. And Brooke was, in a way, responsible for Peter's death, because I was doing a one-man reading of Don Quixote with the LA Guitar Quartet, which I've been touring around with Hawaii and various other parts of the Canada and the United States. And I was doing a performance of that, I think at UCLA. And I invited Peter to see it because he'd love it, you know. And he had revealed to us that he was suffering from a form of leukemia. And we were still writing together because we were trying to put together the Procter & Bergman story and various other things for a publisher who was interested. And I said, come and see it, the show. It's on Saturday night. And he said, well, no. He said, I want to go up and visit Brooke. He was trying to rekindle his relationship with Brooke. And Brooke is a professional nurse now. And so she was giving him advice about it, helping him. So silly Bergman drives up to San Francisco, where she is, spends some time with her, drives back, gets a terrible cold, and the next thing we know, he's in the hospital. Melinda and I were at this time at our timeshare on Kauai with some wonderfully funny Canadian friends of ours. And it rained every day, but maybe two, during the 2 weeks that we were there and the 1 week we were there with them. Torrential, biblical rains. Thunder and lightning and lashing rain and flooding. And Bergman died during this time.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. That's not correct. You didn't beat the Reaper.
We finally ended up, we found a parking place in front of the Golden Dragon, and in we went. We ordered our meal, and I remember the waiter saying, "You gotta order fast because we close soon." Little did I know. So we ordered. I was just dipping into my second helping of hot and sour soup when the shooting broke out, and I remember feeling something going over my head, like, you know, this. What was happening was that they were shooting the table in front of us, and all of the liquid in whatever they were eating and drinking, whatever, was flying over my head. And I looked up and I saw a guy in what I thought was a ski mask with a shotgun.
It was a nylon stocking.
It was a nylon stocking with Asiatic features. It looked like, you know, a ski mask. I ducked under the table. Peter looked over his shoulder. He ducked down as well. And for the next, like, minute and a half, there was constant shooting. Bang, 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 bang. And because the guy had his finger on the BAR and did not take it off, and there were shotgun blasts, blam, blam, and pistol blasts, bang, bang, going on at the same time. And I remember thinking, number one, I was angry. I wasn't frightened at all. I was angry because I thought these are some kind of terrorists. There had been the Symbionese Liberation Army had been blowing up the doors at opera houses at that time.
Same day.
Yeah, and eat the rich. Right. It was all the kind of the anti-bourgeoisie movement or whatever. And we're sitting there, or we're lying there under the table, praying for our lives. And basically, I was thinking, when the drilling is over, you go home. I had this wonderful image of being in a dentist's office and thinking, well, if I survive this, I go home. And if not, well, it's over.
I had the sense of a crystal cocoon over me.
And Peter also had this image of a bullet like a snake.
Like a worm.
Like a worm.
Going up between my legs.
Between his legs and going up his spine, like Kundalini power,
right.
You see? So he was basically the angel, and you also had the image of an angel covering you with his wings.
Right.
And Peter, who was the most vulnerable to this event, was also spared. And I was spared. I remember I was angry because I thought, I'll never get to see my child. What an irony. I've learned that I've created life, and now I'm facing death. What an irony. And finally, the shooting stopped. They went away.
I jumped up.
Peter jumped up.
Because I'd been in the Army, and well, I knew the ordnance was empty. I could tell from having been on a lot of Army rifle ranges. I jumped up, caught a good solid 45-degree angle of the guy going out and testified and sent him away for life.
Let's shoot him up. Now, patient, you have 10 seconds to tell us what you've got and beat the Reaper.
I'm shaking feverish. My hands are all... I'm turning yellow. My God, I've got jaundice.
Jaundice it is! Give it me! Symptom 6.
Oh, greetings from the President of the United States. Feet... Get moving!
Yes, sir!
What's that, boy?
Yes, sir!
What do you say?
Yes, sir!
Speak English, troop!
Yes, sir!
You ain't got no friends on the left!
You're right!
You ain't got no friends on the right!
You're left!
Hound dog!
One, two!
Boontang!
Tree frog!
Hound dog! Boontang! Coontown!
That's right!
Hound dog! Boontang!
Sergeant Imperial.
Sergeant Imperial. Peter had a good one, yeah.
Mine was Sergeant Imperial. That's right. Sergeant Imperial was a Cancer. No, he was a Leo, man. And he knew that everybody called him Frog. And he lived off of that fact. And that, and everybody called him Frog became part of that thing. You know, they'd sit there and they go, here comes the frog. Grib it. And he'd get out there and look like a frog. The man really did look like a frog. Bless him.
You know, we're the last generation, man, maybe you and I, at least specifically, to be in the Army, basically. Yeah. It is our job to pass on information of a body or useful nature to people who'll never have to go through what we did. Because, like, I certainly hope that no young man in this day and age is going in, for God's sake. I mean, certainly I would hope you're not doing it.
You don't have to. You know.
No, you don't have to do it, man. And we'll tell you about it if you feel that there's anything that you may be missing. We're perfectly available at any time to sit around and tell you gory old Army stories, but there's no need to do it yourself.
Secret number one, it's not going to be public, which is you don't have to cut your hair. All reservists. Attention, all reservists. Beep, beep, beep. Driving home from hell. This is Sunday, right?
Oh, this is
you it. Don't have to cut your hair.
Yeah,
no
you guys,
further.
See, let me tell them about Catch 23, man. Yeah. The Army, if you do something weird, like letting your hair grow, which Bergman and I both did, which got us out, because then they think that you're crazy because you don't want to cut off all your hair and stand around in straight lines. They won't really do anything bad to you, but all you've got to do is convince them that you really don't agree with them. They call that crazy. And
being yourself.
Being weird, right. And it will either get you special privileges for being crazy. Like when I went to summer camp once, they wouldn't let me pull KP. They wouldn't let me do it because
hair
my
was
hair
too
was
long.
Too long,
right.
And it was dirty.
Gets
you
caught
see.
In the drains.
You get into interesting situations like that, and cause a lot of ruckus, and feel somehow as if you're doing something for the revolution, or carry a little farther, and you just get out. They just let you out eventually, saying, "Oh well," because they don't really want you, man, and they especially wouldn't want you if you started acting weird.
I don't mean to foment revolution or anything like that.
We've got 537 overstrength by 5% men in this unit, and Mr. Bergman. This Army has never lost a war, and it's not going to lose a war to you.
The reservist can't say anymore that he's not involved, not after Kent State or anything like that. It's really hard. I'm
involved in what?
I'm
involved
like a,
in what, Phil?
I'm an Aries, man. I'm on an Army non-recruiting trip, right?
The fact is, yeah.
Your
right.
Army non-recruiting
if I were straight, I'd be in the Army, and since I'm not straight, I tend to recruit
too,
people
you?
For the anarchist Army, right? I'm dangerous.
The anarchist Army. Anybody who comes up in for basic training is out.
Right. Anybody who stands in a straight line has to go home.
Listen, I mean, like, if you're inside the Army and you've signed a contract and you're going by their law, then take a look at the law if you must and find out what they can't do to you. It's a bluff. It's a four-card. It's called a four-flush. I don't know if you know the word four-flush. It means
yeah,
four to a flush.
Yeah.
It means that fifth card they ain't got.
Yeah.
They can't send you to Vietnam. They can't put you into the bowels of death for you know, growing your hair. They'll offer you out.
Yeah, they will indeed, because they know who hippies are, and they know they don't want hippies, and they know that they see really, in the Army, really the whole idea is having a jolly good time.
The Army is for
it's
people.
It's having
who
everybody
be in it.
Who all feels good, and they all like to get out there in uniforms and do that. And the minute you show them that you don't want to do that, well, they will indeed let you out.
Sure, because otherwise you will become a special thing. A martyr in spite of yourself, and they can't stand to have that in the unit.
They
want to
have a good time.
They want to have a. They want the guys there who want to be there, so they can sit around and all agree to bitch at least. They like to bitch, right?
They like to do that.
They like to bitch, but
they like to camp out every summer and get away
campy.
From their wives.
Yes, man, and they love to drink
it's
beer together.
It's the Junior Fascist League. It's just like.
And they don't like to you know, to get drunk and scream about the hippies. They'd rather get drunk and sing about the good old days, like poor old Adolf Hitler. Whatever happened to Adolf? Let them be sent. Let them be
good
sent.
Good old Adolf.
Whatever happened to Alamein?
Yeah.
You know.
And Eisenhower and Adolf, the great Germans.
The great Germans.
Hitler and Eisenhower. God, they were great.
Oh, they're beautiful people.
And Franklin Roosevelt, the greatest Jewish German general. God, he was
gave
wonderful.
Gave us a war I'll never forget.
Oh, what a wonderful war. These young kids, they don't want to die in the war.
Okay.
What's wrong with them?
Okay.
Well, okay. Well, we won't have them out
let
here.
Let us live outside of it then.
Let's fix them. Let's send them all home.
We'll send them home.
We'll all send them all home.
I can't
then,
do it.
Then it'll just be you and me and Ferguson and West Virginia and Alabama and all the old boys
that's
and the old
right.
outfits. and we'll get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And we'll be uncomfortable, and we'll bind ourselves into tight uniforms that are all starched, and we'll clean everything up, and then we'll be happy.
Right, and we'll wear khaki, sort of nothing.
And we'll salute each other even in bed at night as we wrap our arms around each other and sob ourselves.
One final mushroom of agony. Sir, slowly, Charlie, sir. Pick four.
Yes, come on in, come on in.
Private Parts reporting for duty, sir.
Private Parts, we have a message for you to inform the rest of all the youngsters.
Tell them, Lord.
Tell them to go home. We don't want them.
Home, sir?
Go home. Yeah, just go home. We don't need them.
Golly gee.
With their
sideburns. Get the hell out of here.
Just get the hell out.
I've
we
never
don't
heard them
care.
Talk like that before.
Just go on out of here. We don't love you anymore.
That's an order.
You don't want to die for your country.
Yes,
what good are you?
Sir.
Yeah, you bet you.
Do I have to take any orders anymore?
No, no, man. No. You don't have to.
I don't have to say
man.
Yes, sir, or no, sir.
No, just
no, sir.
Go away,
just get
Daddy-O.
Go away.
Daddy-O.
Reed Jackson.
Yeah,
Reed just
Jackson.
Split.
Dig
well,
private.
Just wait,
you guys.
Just,
but you guys, split. I thought I was going to learn a trade.
No.
I'll
trade you. I'll trade you my uniform for your discharge.
Teach him how to be a boss, Jock.
Uh-huh.
Because Peter Bergman, he was due to be drafted, but Lyndon B. Johnson intervened and put him into a special program, arts program, over in Berlin with people like, not David Mamet, but another famous writer like that, this back brain I have to deal with it. But anyway, he was saved from the draft. And yet the first time that I reconnected with Peter before sitting on his face was back in New York in my apartment on my third floor walk up in Brownstone on West 11th Street. I had hooked up with Susan Ansbach before anything happened to her career. She had been told by Helen Hayes that she's got to go into show business because she was so talented. And she went to some Catholic university. Helen Hayes came out to speak to the students, saw her work, and said, girl, you got to do it. Wow. You got to go for it. And somehow I ended up sleeping with her, you know, the next day or something. So I wake up in the morning with beautiful Susan Ansbach in my arms, and there's a knock on the door. And I said, knock on my door? And I go and I open the door, and it's Peter Bergman. I hadn't seen him since Yale. And he's in an army uniform, and he's got a guitar. And he comes in, and we all have breakfast together, and he sings, you know, folk songs and wobbly songs to us and tells me something about his life, a little bit about it, and disappears. Gone until I sit on his face. And
this
and
is like the best Coen Brothers idea
I've
ever heard in my life.
The man
life.
Was a magical sprite who didn't exist except
oh
in these
my
moments.
God.
And in the war movies, you ever played the little game of trying to find out before the first reel is over all the guys are going to get killed? That is the guy that always says, I got this lucky piece, Charlie, and as long as I got this lucky piece, nothing can happen to me.
What'd
he's
you
dead.
Do with your lucky piece?
I left it back in the barrack. That's it.
That's
he's
it.
Gone, right? Well, it's like in the war movies, the ones in the planes. Every time they cut the film so that you see the Japanese guns first, right? You know the guy in the American plane's going to get hit, right? Every time they show the American guns, the Jap goes. About a 3-to-1 ratio.
Somewhere in the South Pacific, 1943.
Two.
Captain! Captain, fighter planes at 12 o'clock, sir.
Don't worry, bosun. It's only 11:30. Give me my binoculars. By God, they're Japanese!
The planes?
No, my binoculars. Now, don't worry, men. The planes are flying farther and farther away. Bye!
Oh, Captain, turn your binoculars around.
Thank you, Henderson. I got you right. They're getting closer and closer. Dive!
Dive, dive, dive.
Dive,
dive, dive.
That's an order. Dive!
Dive, dive. Dive.
Okay. Captain, begging your permission, sir.
Beg away.
The men have asked me to tell you, this is in the submarine.
The Firesign Theater.
What are we going to do, Captain? What's that?
Sir, excuse me, Lieutenant. Sir, man, what are we going to do?
We're going to lock and load, Private.
And then we're going to go out there and we're going to... Kick him?
Oh, wait a minute. I know what he means. Kick him. He means Kurosawa him. Because Kurosawa makes the greatest war movies.
Yeah,
Kurosawa.
Oh, no. Kubrick him. You know, the World War One with that pan down the trenches.
Coppola. A Coppola now, man. And again. And again. You were dead, man. You were cut.
Alvaredo. Sir, what are we going to do, man? Matetsky, take it easy, Lieutenant. Tire Biter, we're gonna go out there and cut. I can't say it. I'm sorry, but I zip beep.
Can you remember now, Lieutenant?
Surrogate General Klein, sir. When I signed my contract with you, I fully intended to fulfill its terms with honor, sir. But you never told me I had to go out there and kill anybody.
Lieutenant, we will not tolerate the use of prohibited language in this courts martials. The accursed will be advised of the absence of his rights under the secret code of military toughness and will act accordingly.
Best review I ever read on the Firesound Theater was in Rolling Stone, when a guy wrote in to say that he would be listening to us in the rice paddies in Vietnam with the bullets flying over his head on his earphones. It was the only thing that kept him sane. I like that review because I got to tell you, the Firesound Theater, as I see it, can't speak for all four of the guys, but I think it's very true, were a platoon of guerrillas. From 1968 to 1973, we fought the Holocaust in Vietnam, and we won. And we all are the walking wounded because of it. We are veterans. We are truly Vietnam veterans. People didn't spit on us because we spat first, but we were guerrillas, and I honor us for that. I think we ought to get ribbons, small ribbons that we could wear in the lapels of our tank tops.
Hello, player. Hawkmoth! You have come to sacrifice the Sphinx?
Well, no, Laura. I don't want to sacrifice you.
Or save me and win the game?
Oh, I don't care about winning. I just want to save you.
Then, tell me a lie that isn't a lie. Or into the burning pit fall I.
No, Laura. Don't fall in the pits. Wait, a lie that isn't a lie. I don't know how to... I don't know how to love you!
Who are these guys that are in the studio? You know, like, we can't do that. We gotta, like, just... We can't have more than three people in the studio because of the microphones.
Oh, I think they're, some people from Hollywood Provo.
Yeah, well, You'll have to come back a little later. The thing is, look, I'll put you over to Donna, and she'll take care of you, and you get on the other side of the glass, because we got, I got a guy on the telephone, all right? Would you mind, maybe I can talk to the, hey.
Good evening, Michael.
Good evening, Peter.
And good evening, KPFK audience. At this time, Hollywood Provo presents 2 hours of continuous sign-offs. Station KPFK, listener-supported Pacifica Radio for Southern California, transmits from Mount Wilson with an effective radiated power of 110,000 watts on an assigned frequency of 90.7 megacycles. Provo regrets any temporary discomfort it may have caused Peter Bergman and the night staff of radio station KPFK. KPFK, with offices and studios at 3729 Cahuenga in North Hollywood, now unfortunately concludes this day of broadcasting. Good night and continued good wishes from Provo.
Danger! Where's the fire?
In your eyes, Lieutenant Bradshaw.
Don't get wise with me, Peeper. You're lucky we didn't burn you on the Anselmo pederasty case.
Look, you caught him, didn't you?
Yeah, but the punk got away, no thanks to you.
Well, what brings your flat feet sniffing around here now, copper?
Just a friendly word of advice, Danger.
Yeah, what?
Don't go sticking your big nose into police business.
Sure, Lieutenant. Is that all?
No! Don't talk with your mouth full.
Okay, Bradshaw.
And don't fidget while I talk to you.
Sure,
and
Lieutenant.
Stop tracking mud across my nice, clean...
Okay.
Hello, this is Peter Bergman, and welcome to another edition of True Confessions of the Real World. America is now deep in the throes of Operation Enduring Freedom, the 8th war that our country has fought in my lifetime. Some were tiny, like Grenada and Panama. Some were really big, like World War II, which started exactly 90 days after I was born. I remember the Second World War as a very young boy on the home front. gasoline ration coupons stuck to the windshield of the family car, no butter, just awful white oleomargarine with yellow color packets you had to blend in by hand. We'd save our used cooking grease and tinfoil from cigarette packs, all of which got turned over at the grocery store for the war effort. Everything was save, save, save.
I'll read my poem. It's the right time.
Okay.
In honor of the smog. In honor of the smog, I make beer. I smoke lots of jugged bandgrass. I pickle various vegetables. I pickle the easy pickling cauliflower. I pickle the unpeelable Oaxaca that my friend at the RR Market said I could peel, along with the palombra he gave me. In honor of the smog, I watch the wind chimes and the toyon tree, which I believe has been partially killed by the smog. In honor of the smog, I paint a bright yellow eight-pointed sun on top of the day on which this poem is being read.
This is John Knightley speaking to you direct from the Demo Publican National Convention, where Crank Fleming's keynote address is already in progress.
I said, hush, Foghead! And furthermore, let's look at the farm problem. We store millions,
said millions of pounds of surplus food, but
the Mexican army is eating salami and onions, crumpy roux.
We now pause for station identification.
ABCWXYZ.
In conclusion, I say, put us in office, and once more the Liberty Bell will ring.
This is Walter Buckskite on the convention floor with Averill and Herringbone. Sir, will your past record affect your chances this year?
Please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead.
And now we switch you to the main caucus room.
What the heck is all that noise about?
Man, you're talking about a party.
Now, up to the rostrum where Chairman Sam Sunburn is calling the roll.
Nebraska nominates Joe E. Smith.
Thank you, friends.
No, 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 no.
Any other nominations?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, the delegation from California, home of Death Valley, America's playground, nominates the people's choice.
We interrupt most honorable broadcast for special news bulletin.
What'd I say?
This is John Knightley again. The nomination has been conceded to
MIGKEYMOUSE.
Mick Jagger playing on the jukebox. Ducks struggling in oily water. Cars going by loud and out of place. 55-year-old workmen who know how to fix their campers, handing buckets of crap to hippies and taking buckets of crap from hippies, and me crying in a Mexican cafe because I can feel paradise so close now for everybody. I think we got most of the birds out of the south end of the bay, he says, taking off his pink anodized hard hat and wiping some sweat off his forehead right where his thinning pack of black-gray hair begins. The hippie is falling asleep over his coffee. Across the street, in front of the Sunset Beauty Salon, the sidewalk is turning gray and shifting and melting as 1,000 years pass and flowers and Indian tobacco and sage and people looking a little Chinese spring up out of the street. The beauty salon is a field now with two people making love by a brown rock. I'll cry any day for that. My vision starts in my feet and goes down, so my crying is really like rain. My tears make the years pass like a rush. My tears make the seeds grow under Sunset Boulevard. The clump of cane by the brown rock is the 1,000-year-old child of my tears, and that boy is the 1,000-year-old child of that hard hat, and that girl filled with him, her sweet self coming with a cry in the California clay, is the 1,000-year child of that hippie. And the ducks made it too. So don't despair. Learn to hold back and let it out like the Stones' guitar. The war is over. We're home. And when we all wake up, we'll all be friends. Dear friends.
Thank you.
My eyes, I love you more.